Welcome to Meta Strategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Kim Stevenson back to the broadcast. Kim is the Chief Information Officer of Intel, a $55 billion technology company that designs and manufactures digital technology platforms. Kim leads the more than 6,000 worldwide IT employees to drive competitive advantages and provide IT solutions. Prior to joining Intel, Kim spent 7 years at the former EDS, now HP Enterprise Services, in a variety of positions, including Vice President of Worldwide Communications, Media, and Entertainment, Industry Practice, and Vice President of Enterprise Service Management, where she oversaw the global development and delivery of enterprise services. Before joining EDS, Kim spent 18 years at IBM in several executive positions, including Vice President of Marketing and Operations of the eServer iSeries division. Kim currently serves on the board of directors of Cloudera and Boston Private Financial Holdings Incorporated. Kim has a bachelor's degree from Northeastern University, and she has an MBA from Cornell University, where she is currently a member of the advisory board. I recently caught up with Kim in her office in Silicon Valley, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as we discussed how she works to enact cultural change at the organization. Principle 2, infrastructure, as we discuss security and how she balances risk mitigation with innovative activities. We also discussed the state of women in technology, how she approaches social media, her experience on the boards of companies and the learnings she has brought back to Intel, the methods she used to get on boards in the first place, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Kim Stevenson, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. It's great to be with you again. I thought we'd begin here. We're relatively new into the year here, and I thought we would talk a bit about some of your priorities in the year ahead. I know from things that I've recently read that among the priorities that you have for the year ahead include adoption of big data analytics to find opportunities and to solve challenges faster.
Yep.
And I wonder if you could explain some of the ways in which IT is going to do that, and I'd love to hear some other priorities that are on your roadmap.
Yeah. I'll start with analytics, and it's what I call at the top of my pyramid because it is a transformational initiative around Intel. We've been doing a lot with analytics over the last few years, and we've released some information about driving revenue through use of analytics. But I've shifted from a technology view for 2016 to a leadership problem, right? So we're bringing our entire Intel leadership team forward to think about shifting using big data predictive analytics versus traditional statistical methods and the precision and the improvement that you can get through that. And the reason I say it's a leadership problem is because often you'll find in a predictive model that you'll get answers that are inconsistent with your historical experience. We use regression analysis a lot here at Intel. So if you look at a regression analysis line, you effectively get a mean and you drive towards that regression line. If you use an isobar analysis, what you get is the personalization of hotspots, and you would maybe take 3 or 4 different actions than what a regression line would tell you. So you get good results with traditional statistics. You can get outstanding results if you switch to the more predictive models. And that takes a shift in a leadership mindset as much as it does a technology mindset. So we've been working on that with our most senior leaders at Intel. And the receptivity is really high, but the cultural shift is also really difficult.
And I know you've talked about the need for IT to be an advocate for this change, that IT needs to drive it. What are the methods you're using in communicating this? You've talked about how the cultural change, as any cultural change, takes a little while. What are some of the methods you're doing to sort of prove the value and to provide a vision of what the benefits that the organization will garner for this journey?
Yeah, so we start with really trying to understand what problem our business unit partners might be suffering from, that and they haven't been able to solve. You want to pick the problem that is to the point where they're like, they just want to give up on it because they've tried methods and they just don't get great results. And then you want to do it quick. So you want to take off a piece of that that you can spend weeks to a short few number of months to get them progress on that problem. And that becomes your proof point. And I purposely don't call them POCs and pilots like traditional IT solutions would. Right, we're trying to do a really quick, rapid development process, get them something that shows results that then you can expand on. And we said it's, if we can take five people over 6 months, you would get $10 million in value. And we always say 5 + 6 = 10. And that's kind of comical at Intel because we're sort of all mathematicians and you know the math doesn't matter. But you know it strikes a chord. So you do that, and then we work then on that buy-in in that expansion plan. We did it for this particular area, now let's do it for more. And we continue to add on. So all of our analytic projects end up being multi-year projects with the same overarching goal, but just in chunks that can be delivered quickly. And then we're loud and proud about the results, right? So we'll share with sister organizations, we did this for this team, we could do that for your team. And we've built our algorithms that we've written, we've built into reusable libraries. So we are getting faster and better at delivering. You know, you have to spend the time to understand the business problem, and that time doesn't change every time. But when you have reusable algorithms, you can actually build models pretty quickly.
That's great. And I know that some of this is covered in your IT annual plan. Can you talk a bit about some of the other things that are among the priorities listed in the IT annual plan?
So the theme sort of this year is backroom to boardroom. So there's never really been a time in the profession of IT where it's so critical to the company's strategy and the operational performance of the company. So you have both the strategic vector and the operational performance vector. That combined with cybersecurity means almost every topic that goes into the boardroom has a technology element to it. And so whether we're supporting a business unit plan or how we might go through a digitization strategy to reach more customers, to engage our customers deeper into the design process, or we're going through a risk management process where we're talking about cyber risk and cyber events, both externally that are happening that we might need to be aware of, but also internally that what we're seeing and experiencing. Both of those discussions are required that IT be present and have a point of view that takes the company forward.
And I also wanted to talk to you a bit about the IT annual plan process itself. We've talked about mm-hmm. a bit about it mm-hmm. in the past, but now you're several turns into this.
Yeah.
And I'd love to talk more about the advantages that you've had by communicating so openly, not only with your colleagues inside of Intel, your external partners, even the broader public can have access to significant portions of your IT annual plan. Can you talk a little bit about now several turns in the process, how it's been honed, and the advantages you've garnered from putting it together?
Fundamentally, at the core of it, I believe that it is a 10K and a 10Q. Just like a financial organization for a public health company has to report to the SEC, you know, your annual 10K filing and your quarterly 10Qs, that's how I view the IT report. That is so fundamental. Information technology is so fundamental for any company's operating performance. Why wouldn't you be as transparent with what you're doing as you are with your financial results? And so the process we use really starts well before the plan is formed, because we start with our business units and we align to what the business unit priorities and strategies are. And then we carve out as much of our, we have a budget that and has a large piece of the budget that is just our fixed operational cost to run the place day in and day out. We try to drive a lot of productivity and efficiency into our run cost every year that creates more capacity to do innovation projects that satisfy those business unit needs. So once we align with that, and you know, those are interesting discussions because the appetite for every business unit is bigger than any one organization could solve. But sometimes you have to, it's important to sequence change in a certain way. So just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you'll yield all the value if it's not sequenced right. So we don't end up in like vigorous debates. We end up with in sequencing challenges. Like we really are talking about how do we get the most value and how would we sequence things in order to do that. I'm trying to move, my biggest challenge in IT is moving at the speed of the market, right? We have to move quicker. And that single thing drives the investments I make in IT's, the investments I make in my own team for what we do. And then we go through and we're technically based organization, so we publish our technical papers, our architectures, and our reference designs, and we really try to hone in on that aspect of it. And then we're more than willing to share that with, we use mostly industry standard products and stuff. So everything that's not intellectual property of Intel, we're willing to share. My philosophy on that is that it's about the profession and moving the profession forward. We're a very social group, IT profession, because we know each other, we go through the same problems. But if we can learn from one another, that moves us all forward faster. So I like to learn from my colleagues, and I hopefully share enough that they learn something from us too.
No doubt. You mentioned innovation is one of the mandates. You talked about how IT's role in bringing to life innovation within the business units, for instance, and the need, of course, to draw efficiencies in the run capabilities to create the bandwidth and the funding to be able to push more and more of that forward. Can you talk a bit about IT's role specifically in some of the innovations that the organization is pulling forward? How do you think about IT's role in engaging the rest of the organization to develop new innovative products or ideas?
Luckily for us in Intel IT, we represent a typical enterprise customer for the products that our company makes. And so we work with our various business units to help them understand how we would think about it. How would we manage it? Why might we buy a new product or a new solution? What would prevent us from buying a new? What do our operational requirements look like? And we're very open in sharing that thought process. It makes our product development teams better at understanding the customer. And so we had in September or October, we had our first ever data center group investor day. So we invited investors in Intel stock into the company. And one of the things we did was the IT team took them on a tour of our data center, our latest and greatest data center. It's the most energy efficient data center in the world. It houses a supercomputer. And we showed them what the data center group does and how it comes to life in an operational environment. And so we feel very proud of the fact that we're able to showcase that technology for our investors and help the business unit validate the market for the products that they're developing.
The company's made some significant investments in recent years in security. McAfee is a great example of that, yes, for instance. And as I hear you talk about innovation, of course, innovation is about risk-taking. Obviously, security is about risk mitigation, two sides of the same, sort of the paradox of an IT, yeah, leader is balancing those two together. Given the very strong capabilities that Intel has developed from a security perspective, I imagine that you also have the opportunity to be customer one, so to speak, with some of the solutions that are being developed there. I'd love to understand not only how you use your own capabilities from a security perspective, but just generally speaking, how you think about security as you're also pushing mandates for the organization to explore risk-taking in appropriate ways, of course.
No surprise to anybody that the climate in the world has changed around cyber risk. It's up for everybody. And we just need to be more cognizant and aware of things that are happening out there that, you may well be exposed to. So we've talked about over the last several years moving from the perimeter, protecting the perimeter, I always said, you know, was used to be keep the bad guys out and let the good guys in. Well, who knows what a bad guy and a good guy is nowadays, right?
And they don't wear black hats and white hats.
They don't tell you, you know. So we really started, you know, a number of years ago thinking about how do I protect my data, right? How do I get down to that granular level of data. I don't think we're completely there yet, but where we are in that journey is, you know, we've adopted the protect, detect, and correct model. And so we're pretty good at the traditional security things, which are, you know, the protection realm. So VPNs, passwords, access management, you know, DMZs, all of them. In the detection area is where we've had to use a lot of big data analytics, right? Because you want to find problems and you want to find them quickly. And in we have 15 billion potential security events a day that have to be analyzed that cannot be done by anything other than a predictive model. It's just too big. You couldn't hire enough people to do that. And so that's a really interesting area and fraught with innovation. As we shift to the cloud and we're moving data to the cloud, it's taking a lot of innovation to secure our data and our assets that we want to move to the cloud, and we want to get the value of the innovation from the SaaS providers, but also we want to keep it secure. And so we've implemented a number of solutions that are from, you know, startup companies, from the McAfee source, and even, you know, algorithms and stuff that we're writing for our own analysis and log management and, you know, things that are some kind of gore, you know, infrastructure, deep in the infrastructure, but important to be able to analyze on a real-time basis.
Very interesting. One of the great things that in contemplating your career arc, one of the things you've accomplished that I know is an ambition of a lot of chief information officers is gaining board access.
Mm-hmm.
June of 2014, you joined the Cloudera board. Last year, in October, you joined the Boston Private Financial Holdings board. You previously were on the Riverbed Technology board. You've been on some nonprofit boards as well. I'd love to talk to you about, knowing that your peer group includes a great number of people who would wish to follow in your footsteps, I'd love to understand the genesis of this. How did you begin the process of making people aware that you were hoping to join a board? Who were they? How did you, were there things you were doing with your own capabilities to give yourself confidence that you were in a position that you thought you could serve a board
mm-hmm.
well?
Mm-hmm. I have for a long time held a personal goal that I would like to join a board. And in 2012, I finally said, well, okay, how much longer are you going to say you want to do this before you do something about it? So I decided I was going to do something about it. And I had been serving on nonprofit boards for a number of years. So I understood board governance. I understood, you know, the role of the board in an oversight versus a management capacity. And I really felt it was time to take the next step. And luckily, the world was shifting too, and technology had risen in importance. And so I really decided that, you know, I needed to play a specific role, a specific value add. When I looked at the boards, I interviewed for a number of them. It's a shockingly different experience interviewing for a board than interviewing for a job. And so some I knew right away. I was like, well, I'm really not that interested in their business. And you have to be, you're going to work full time, you're going to take on additional responsibilities, you have to be passionate about their business. That's my number one criteria. And then you have to figure out, on the existing board, what do you bring that the other board members don't bring? And so the first board that I served, public company board, was Riverbed. And I was the only person on the board that was a Riverbed customer. And I had been a Riverbed customer for a long time. So I knew that going in, and that's how I sold my position on the board. That why could I help them? Because I had been their customer. I know how their products work. I know why people would buy their products or not buy their products. I know their competitors. And so I had a unique position that I could offer that was incremental to what the current already strong board had. So I think that's a really important part. You have to figure out what unique thing you bring. And it isn't just I'm a technologist. Right. That's an interesting part, but a lot of people bring that. What is your unique thing, and what does the company need? So you have to spend time to understand the company's strategy. And then you have to tell everyone who will listen that you would like to find a board, because it is a much more informal process than job hunting and looking for a job. It's also a longer-term process. Boards are constantly looking at succession planning and who's going to roll off. And they'll be planning, in 3 years, I know that, you know, this board member is going to roll off. I want to start looking at candidates now for 3 years from now. That was a shock to me. I was kind of like, really? It's not open this minute? I mean, if you're interviewing for a job, it's open right away, right?
Right, right.
So it's a longer, it's a different cycle than, and I had to learn that. And so I think those are all good things for people to consider. And there's also just the practical, like logistically, can you attend the meetings? You know, you have to be a good board member. And so you have to be able to get to the meetings and be there and be dedicated to that time. So you have to think about the logistics, as mundane as that might be.
Mm-hmm. Great points all the way around. I wonder, from having participated in the boards, what you have gained. What have you brought back to your day job by virtue of the experiences you've had, the range of people from various companies, obviously, who participate on the boards that you've participated on? How have you grown as a result of your participation in boards?
I think there's a couple of things that help me every day in my day job, and which is why I would be an advocate to let executives serve on boards. The first is you see the other problems and challenges that companies are experiencing or the growth opportunities, and you get a perspective of that marketplace and how could that impact your company. I also get a strong view into the future, like future strategies of other companies. What are they planning to do? And think about things like, how are you thinking about China? How are you thinking about the macroeconomic conditions? And it's not just the company you're serving on, because everyone at that board table brings that perspective. And so you're really talking about getting 9 different companies and industry perspectives on singular big macro problems that every company has to deal with. And it helps you in your day job think about, are we strategically approaching this in the way that's best for our company? Everybody can approach it differently, but you have to be able to synthesize that down into what's best for your company. So it's been really interesting work, but also really valuable work for my day job.
That's great. You also mentioned, I want to track back to something you mentioned. You probably only half facetiously said you spoke with everyone, told everyone that you wanted to join boards. That included, I assume, executive recruiters, other executives in this company.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about just the specifics of who you spoke with and how that came about?
I told my boss and the head of HR at Intel and stuff, because I know people call other people to see if they can take board positions, right? I called everybody that I knew that served on a board, past and present, old bosses, colleagues at other companies that I worked at, and I just said, hey, I'm interested in this. If you hear anything, for you to think about me. And then recruiters call me all the time for CIO jobs, and I was very deliberate. I always offered them a name of some CIOs that might be good for the positions they were looking for, and then I'd say, and oh, by the way, I'd just like you to know I'm interested in, you know, looking for a board position, and I would ask for advice and recommendations how to do that, and I followed up on every, if somebody gave me a piece of advice, like you should call so-and-so or you should look at this company, I followed up on every single one of those, and I learned, I think I went on 5 interviews before I took my first position. And I learned something in every one of those interviews, which was good. It's good to learn what you're not going to like as much as what you will like. So it was a really interesting process. And I definitely think that the demand for people who understand technology and how it can help execute your company strategy is high in the boardroom. And so it's a great time for people in the CIO roles to pursue that.
As I think about our conversation today, Kim, one of the themes, one of the threads through this is transparency. Transparency of one's strategy through the IT annual plan, transparency mm-hmm. of your own intent and your own objectives and the benefits that have garnered for you. As I think about that transparency and the communication that's required in order to, and the various forms that are required to be transparent. Another area of communication that you've been very progressive with is social media.
Yeah.
I put out my own last April list of the top 20 social CIOs in the U.S., and you were number 5 on that list. And I know as someone who follows you that you're very active on in various places, the usual suspects of Twitter yeah. and LinkedIn, among others. And I'd love to just understand from you the way you approach social media. Personally, what you mentioned earlier that one of your passions is moving the practice of IT forward, not just Intel mm-hmm. IT, but general IT. And so I can only imagine that that is part of what you're hoping to do is give a little, get a little as through the yeah. correspondences you have yeah. there. But I'd love to hear in your own words how you approach your own thought process when it comes to social media.
Yeah, so I'm a reader. I love reading, and I'll read anything you give me. However, my time is a huge problem. I just don't have enough time. So I've cultivated the people that I follow on social media are people that write things that I find interesting. And I try to stick to an agenda. So I spend my time, my content that I create for social media will always be about technology, women in tech, the transformation of business today due to technology. That's what I am passionate about. So all the content that I create will revolve around those three themes. I mean, I have other interesting things in my life, but I choose that, you know, I just don't have time to actually put them out. And those are the three needles that I'd like to move forward. And I think it's important it's about creating your brand, right? So if you're going to be out there in social media, it's no different than being a keynote speaker, that you have a brand, you stand for something, and you need to be consistent and clear about what that is. So now, then I use social media to, you know, help me learn things that I don't know. And I just yesterday, I reached out to someone who I am connected with on social media. I've never met the person, but respect the content they've created. And I invited that person to speak at my annual Leaders Summit in the end of February. Never met the person. And I'm excited beyond all get out that, you know, we connected. You know, we did our direct messaging to one another, and we're setting that up. Mm. So it's very productive also. And if I had unlimited time, you know, it would be a different story, but I don't. And this, it's just a very efficient way to get things done and stay connected on things that I care about and hopefully share things that other people care about.
You mentioned one of your passions is women in technology and encouraging mm-hmm. women to follow in the trail that you're blazing and others like you have. What's the state of the union in your mind of progress made of women in technology? What are some of the things you're advocating for continued progress?
Look, I think that there's never been a better time for women in tech, primarily because the way the work is changing in general, its work itself is becoming much more collaborative, it's becoming much more social, and in general, women like that kind of work. If you can even look in the IT ranks at any company, you'll find a lot of women in the project management, program management roles, right? Because they're leading teams, they're coordinating resources, they're bringing the projects to fruition. And that's how work gets done nowadays. And so I think the time is great. I think there are a lot of biases that... you know, a guy from Stanford said, you know, if you have a brain, you have your bias. So we're all biased. I'm biased. You're biased. Uncovering those biases and being much more self-aware, I think, is that next step in the workplace that will really make everyone feel more inclusive and try to get the best out of everybody. And I think that we're taking great steps in that area, and you can see you know, Intel's been very transparent about our diversity initiatives and where we stand. I think our CEO and released some information just this week at CES on how much progress we've made. You know, but we have a lot more to go. I mean, we were not, as an industry and as a profession, you know, there's a lot to happen. And it's going to take, I believe it's going to take sort of change agents to stand out there and question the norms. You have to question people who, you know, are making those traditional decisions because they're not looking beyond the circle that they know to find the best talent. Right, and you're going to have to look in some diverse areas to get the best talent.
Mm. What do some of those include? As you've looked for some of those future, especially female leaders, what are some avenues you'd recommend?
Well, I recommended to my staff a couple years ago that they all attend a diversity event, internal or external, for a group that they weren't a part of. So if you're a female, then maybe you should, and you're Caucasian, maybe you should go to a Hispanic event. Or if you're, you know, a male, maybe you should go to a female event. Because once you understand the group and start to understand, but you meet so many people, you know. So I used to go to the National Association of Black MBAs conference every year. I met some tremendously talented people, but if I didn't put myself in that situation, I would have said, "Well, there are no African Americans that I can hire," because you don't know them. You have to put yourself in a situation where you actually meet them. And there are groups for everything. And again, we have them internally and we have them externally. So the Anita Borg Institute runs a Grace Hopper Conference every year. 10,000 technical women attend. So don't tell me there's not technical women. Go to Grace Hopper, yeah. Right? Go to a SWE event. Go to a WITI event. I mean, there's all sorts of events where people, and women want to progress their careers. So you will find women who really want to do big things, create big impacts. If you put yourself in that situation, but it might be uncomfortable if you've never been. So, you know, we have to all expand our comfort zones.
Exactly. Well, Kim Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors.
For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.